Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Cornyn, and I represent Detective Donald Shepard of the City of Champaign Police Department. We're here on appeal from Judge McCuskey's denial of his motion for summary judgment, which was based on qualified immunity. There are three points I'd like to make. One is I believe that the right plaintiff claims was violated, was not clearly established in the law, at least not under the circumstances facing Detective Shepard. Second, that there were no facts from which deliberate indifference to a serious risk of suicide were presented to show that Detective Shepard could have violated.
Why wasn't what Cavalieri's mother told Shepard enough to alert him that there was a significant suicide risk?
The fact that Mrs. Cavalieri told Detective Shepard that her son was suicidal has to be considered in the scheme of facts that Detective Shepard knew at that point in time, approximately 11 or 11:15 in the morning. He had already interviewed Mr. Cavalieri prior to the time custody was transferred to the Champaign County Jail. Cavalieri at that time, as the trial court held, presented nothing which would have alerted Detective Shepard that he was suicidal. There was nothing in the subsequent interview with the ex-girlfriend hostage that Cavalieri had taken which would have indicated that he was suicidal. In fact, just the opposite.
Ask, though, taking the facts, which of course we all must, that this, for this kind of an appeal, as Cavalieri presents them, in her deposition, I thought she said that Shepard told her that Stephen was upset during his interview. Now, of course, she's talking about something she was directly told. And it strikes me that we do need to accept those versions of the facts and also the fact that her information, you know, this is a person who's attempted suicide. And didn't she also tell him that there was this earlier incident in a couple months earlier when he'd been put on suicide watch?
Yes, she does testify, Your Honor, that she told Detective Shepard that he had been in jail earlier and on suicide watch.
So she tells him both that he could be suicidal now and that he's on suicide watch. How much more does a detective need? And how free is he to disregard these kinds of warnings?
Your Honor, I would point out that if indeed he had been on suicide watch the month earlier, he had been on suicide watch in the very jail that he was now in.
But our point is, you were saying that there weren't facts presented to Detective Shepard that would have alerted him to this risk, and it seems to me this is at a minimum these are disputed facts, which you know may turn out favorably to your client, but we can't resolve a qualified immunity issue if they're really disputed.
Your Honor, let me go to that. Let's concede those facts for the point of argument, and at least insofar as today, although I have argued in the brief that I believe that you have to look at the text, all the facts in totality. But what I want to point out today is that I don't believe the constitutional right was clearly established. Judge McCuskey stated that the constitutional right that was clearly established was a police officer could be liable for a pretrial detainee suicide if he was deliberately indifferent to a substantial suicide risk. But the only cases that we have found that indicate that a duty by a police officer is owed, and I take it that the constitutional duty, the correlative right being the right which has to be violated, is owed by those who have custody.
Now,
Detective
Shepard
did not.
If Detective Shepard had learned that Mr. Cavalieri had a severe case of epilepsy and was likely to go into seizures at any minute, is it your view that he was perfectly entitled to just go off and have lunch and not bother to tell anybody to whom he had transmitted custody?
If I'm addressing that from a constitutional point of view, yes.
All right. And you also think if he had learned that he was HIV positive and bleeding, that he could have just kept his mouth shut and not said a word?
Yes.
Just let the other officer
What if he knew that Cavalieri had a cobra in his pocket?
Or a bomb,
or a
hidden gun.
And you really think that, and so Cavalieri, the bomb blows up and kills other prisoners in the jail. You mean that Shepard would be entitled to qualified immunity?
Yes. Let's focus on who he owes the duty to, Your Honor. He may owe a duty,
actually,
a tort duty, to other prisoners who might have been injured.
But
he may have owed a tort duty to somebody else. But we're asking, does he owe a constitutional duty to Cavalieri?
Is there any sense to your position?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there is. A police officer who arrests a criminal suspect and turns him over to an arresting agency, no longer has custody of him, then goes on forward with a criminal investigation. There are many, many things
That's not the case. Take the bomb case, right? He knows the prisoner has a bomb on him, and he doesn't bother to tell the jail personnel. Now, and you said, no, he has qualified immunity for this.
I believe that. Well, the question is, who does he owe the duty to? In this case, Cavalieri claims.
Forget this case. In the bomb case, I mean, in general, in tort law, you owe a duty to people endangered by your recklessness.
Well, right. Are you suggesting, though, because I would take issue, if you're suggesting that the duty is owed to the person carrying the bomb, then
no.
I'd say, no, I don't believe it is. It may be owed. You may owe a tort duty to other people who might get injured if you haven't passed out a warning. But in this case, the person who's claiming that we had knowledge about him, that's the one who says we violated the constitutional duty owed to him.
How about
so
this
he
case?
Says, you know, I have a bomb, it'll just blow me up. Then it's all right. Then the officer says, well, I don't owe you a duty, so I won't bother to mention it.
Your Honor, I would point out that I haven't found a case, plaintiff hasn't found a case.
Of course, because
court
some cases are so clear cut that you know that they never get litigated.
And also this court,
well, we've made clear that it's not a sine qua non to reject a qualified immunity defense that you find a case, because if it's preposterous, if it's obvious, then you don't need a case.
Your Honor, in Payne for Hicks versus Turchis, this court implied without a specific holding that the only time an arresting officer owes a duty is during the time he has him in custody.
But
in
the
that
facts
case,
of Payne were quite different, as I'm sure you remember. The officer didn't know anything, was the whole point. The guy was kind of drunk under the car, and there was no knowledge. Here we have, what do we do when knowledge comes into the hands of an officer? And that's completely different from Payne.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cornyn. Mr. Forrester?
May it please the Court, Mr. Cornyn? Your Honors, if it were not for the transfer of custody aspect of this case, I believe it's common ground that this would be a garden variety qualified immunity situation. And Mr. Shepard is hanging his hat on the fact that...
By which you mean what? That there clearly is or there clearly is not qualified immunity?
That Mr. Shepard would not be entitled to.
Would not, okay.
but I believe that the defense position, as just articulated by Mr. Cornyn, is that when custody was transferred to the county, it's no longer our problem. It's now the county's problem. We have no duty to tell the county anything.
But how far would you extend this? You don't want poor Detective Shepherd to just have to stay on the phone every second when he transfers custody of individuals to other, you know, to the county, to the state, to whomever received it.
No, I wouldn't want him to sit by the phone, Your Honor, but I do believe when knowledge comes to Detective Shepherd of the nature that we must assume he had for the purpose of this appeal, that the duty does arise and the decompartmentalization of the departments does not suspend
Doesn't
or terminate
Doesn't the jail have an intake officer who interviews the arrestees and asks them about suicide?
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact that happened in this case. And Cavalieri, as the record shows, indicated to the jail officer that he did not have any suicidal impulses. That's true. The question that's before this court, though, is what were Shepherd's responsibilities? I think there are a couple of district court cases from the Northern District of Illinois that aren't binding, of course, but they're instructive. One is that Ramirez case that's brought up in the brief, where the district court described as breathtakingly cynical the paramedics' argument that they owed no duty to a man lying bleeding in front of them because that man at that time happened to be in the custody of the police department, not in the fire department's custody. These were fire department medics. And they said state action cannot be diluted by being spread over several departments. Again, it's not binding, but I think it's clearly instructive. And in Viero, also another Northern District of Illinois case, you had a juvenile probation officer who had knowledge about a juvenile's suicide risk. That wasn't passed on, and the juvenile committed suicide in jail, clearly not under the juvenile probation officer's custody. Nevertheless, there was
that,
no
that deliberate indifference, then?
I'm sorry, sir?
Was that a deliberate indifference situation?
That was a deliberate indifference case. It wasn't decided on appeal on the basis. It was a question of fact, whether there was a deliberate indifference or not.
At least from my point of view, let's assume that it's clearly established that if someone comes into custody that is unquestionably suicidal and you just say, I'm not on my watch, and I'm out of here or something, and there may be some basis for establishing deliberate indifference. But it seems that your opponent was willing to even stipulate to certain facts.
Yeah.
That, and I guess in reciting those facts, are we at a point where, as a matter of law, that is negligence, or is it deliberate indifference? And I guess maybe if you could recite the facts that are not contested for this purpose, and
I
then say why that's deliberate indifference.
I struggle a bit with this because there are shifting standards. There's an objective standard for qualified immunity. An objective standard for qualified immunity, a subjective standard for deliberate indifference. The conclusion I've reached, and perhaps the court would reach the same one, is that deliberate indifference, being a subjective, what did Shepherd know type of question, becomes a question of fact.
There's no way we could decide that here if you set out those facts.
No, I could recite the facts, but there are a number of facts that Shepherd had. From a deliberate indifference point of view, did that give him the requisite knowledge? Again, that's a question of fact that should be decided by the jury, and that knowledge can be inferred from the obviousness of the circumstances. In this case, Shepherd even said to the mother, Stephen will not be alone. I mean, those are his own words. I don't know why Stephen was to be kept alone if there were not some perceived risk that he could do harm to himself or be harmed in some way. He was fine.
So it's to be a fact question, then whether when he says he's not alone, it's because this is in some sort of a collection tank or whatever this room was where there are other people. Well, it turns out they were taken out and he was left alone. But I guess I'm mostly concerned about what this line you draw between deliberate indifference and gross negligence.
I don't know that we even reached the deliberate indifference question in the course of this appeal, given that it's a qualified immunity issue that's before you. In the lower court, both grounds were asserted, qualified immunity and deliberate indifference.
I understand. And so what in an appeal is whether it's qualified immunity. I understand that.
Yes.
It's just that if we look at the issue of whether it's clearly established that a person who is designated suicidal, I guess, as opposed to someone who has some serious illness or something that you just ignore. We know that's clearly established. As to what extent one has to identify the suicidal tendency to to put it into a category of someone who is clearly a risk to his health, even if it's his own personal.
I think isolating that issue, the law is pretty clear, and the law is a subjective standard. It depends on Shepard's knowledge, and that knowledge can be inferred, but still, nonetheless, it is knowledge. He has to know of the suicide risk and deliberately disregard it. Again, I don't think we reached that issue on this appeal, because I think that's a fact question that should be for the trier of fact if the matter is sent back to the district court.
Well, by which you mean there are facts in the record which, if believed by the trier of fact, namely the mother's testimony and
yes.
so on, would show that he did have that knowledge.
Exactly.
The trier of fact would be free also not to, but it's...
Exactly. Which brings me to a point, just to jump out of the order of what I intended, Dufour decided by this court presents an interesting question, whether this court even has appellate jurisdiction over this matter when there are outstanding facts. I think they used hotly disputed facts was the word, was the language from Dufour.
That's what our position was, that if the officer is willing to concede for purposes of appeal that all the factual disputes have been resolved against him, he can argue, well, even if that's true, still I have immunity because, you know, there was no clearly established right that I violate.
Well, that's true, and the officer has conceded
grudgingly,
the relevant,
but, yeah.
relevant facts. I noticed in the brief there was a bit of a giving and
a
taking
head,
away.
Right, yes.
But assuming the facts are conceded, then DeFore may well not apply. But it is certainly an issue. The last case I wanted to mention to Your Honor was, of course, your own opinion in Salazar. And it wasn't decided on this basis, but in Salazar, again, you had paramedics, and the victim was not in the paramedics' custody. Nevertheless, that issue went to the jury, and the jury had to decide whether the paramedics were or were not qualified with. Given qualified immunity on the basis of that. It just seems like custody, which is the real issue raised by Mr. Shepard, is not the determining factor. The determining factor is whether he acted reasonably under the circumstances with respect to a constitutional right, whether that right, regardless of custody, was clearly established. And I believe it's common ground that that right was established. It's whether it extends to a transfer of custody situation. Nothing further.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Forrester. Mr. Cornyn, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Your Honor, I want to correct one statement recently made, that the duty is to act reasonably under the circumstances. I don't think that is the correct statement. I think it has to be more than just unreasonable conduct. I think it has to be deliberately indifferent in order to breach the constitutional standard. In Saucier versus Katz, the test of whether or not a right was clearly established under the law, as the Supreme Court put it, the key question was, would an officer at the time he acted know that he was violating somebody's rights? The focus is on the time Shepard acted or failed to act, which is at about 11:15, and he did not have custody. No case that anyone has cited has held that an arresting officer must keep a custodial agency apprised of those kinds of facts.
When you say those kinds of facts, though, I mean, as I was saying to Mr. Forrester, I don't think anyone would disagree that, you know, if it turned out Officer Shepard found out that Mr. Cavalieri had a head cold, you know, that he had to call up and make sure they had a supply of Kleenexes, but a risk of death does strike me to be as a rather different matter.
Your Honor, I guess I like bright lines. I defend police officers, and police officers have to make decisions in the street. What if he had found out, not from mom, that she said her son was suicidal, but that her son had been sexually abused as a minor and had a serious drinking problem and was very, very upset and nervous? Some of these are things that a psychiatrist might say is, wow, that's a clear indication of a suicidal or potentially suicidal person.
No, that would be on the other side of the line.
Now you know.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you to both counsel, and...